morning. I call the House Community and Regional Affairs Committee to order. Today is March 24th, and the time is apologetically 8:06 a.m. Members present are Representative Kai Holland, Representative Garrett Nelson, Representative Steve St. Clair, Representative Carolyn Hall, Co-Chair Rebecca Hemshute, and myself, Co-Chair Donna Mears, and we have quorum to conduct business. Just a reminder for everyone, first thing in the morning, please silence your cell phones. If you need to pass a note to committee members, please get the attention of my aide, Talia Ames. Thank you, Talia, and also thanks to Co-Chair Hemshute's committee aide, Thatcher Brower. Before we get started, I'd also like to thank our recording secretary, Kale Brown, and helping us from the June OLIO is Chloe Miller. On today's agenda, we have two bills. First, we're looking to take final action on House Bill 309, Jonesville Public Use Area, sponsored by Representative G. Nelson. This is the bill's third hearing. And last, we will hear from more invited testifiers and have a more in-depth discussion on HB 291 Municipal Property Tax Exemptions, sponsored by Representative Coulomb. Also, welcome here this morning, Representative Coulomb. So, first, House Bill 309, Representative Nelson and staff, Catherine Covey, welcome to the committee this morning. Please come on up to the table and provide a quick recap of the bill. Just to note, we did not receive any amendments for the bill. We also have Rachel Longacre, Chief of Operations from the Division of Mining, Land, and Water from DNR, on the line for questions. Good morning, Representative Parks. Thanks for joining us. So, please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Just to recap, this is cleaning up some property boundaries that were involved in the bill that was originally passed, HB 6, in 2018. Basically removing one piece of ground that was not under state control. It's been under borough control since 1986. And adding one additional piece that was always intended to be in but just got missed when they were drawing the line. So, if there's any further questions, it's something that is supported by the community, by DNR, by the borough, and will allow them to move forward with a more active and cohesive management plan for that particular area. So if there are any additional questions, we'd be happy to field them. And also on the line, as was mentioned, we have Rachel Longacre.
Any further questions from the committee? Well then, Co-Chair Hemshute, you got something to say here?
I do.
Excellent.
I move House Bill 309-34-LS1464-A with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Seeing no objection from committee, House Bill 309-34-LS1464-A moves from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. Brief at ease while we sign our paperwork. Next, we will take up House Bill 291. Representative Cologne and staff Emily Durfee, please welcome to the committee. Approach the table, put yourself on record, and provide us with a quick recap of the bill to get us started here this morning.
So, good morning, Co-Chair Mears and Co-Chair Himmshoop, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Representative Julie Cologne, representing House District 11, which is South Anchorage Hillside.
I'm Emily Durfee, staff to Representative Cologne.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to come back before the Community and Regional Affairs Committee to discuss HB 291. So for context, HB 291 builds on a concept that came to me following a Senator Bjorkman bill to exempt farm structures from property taxes. If a community wants to exempt certain types of property, whether farm structures or others, they should be able to make that decision at the local level. HB 291 is intended to give municipalities the authority to do just that. And under current process, communities must come to the legislature first to create those allowances before they can present them to their voters. This bill shifts that decision-making power at the local level. And at our last meeting, we did not have the opportunity to go too in-depth on the bill. And if the committee were open to it, there are a couple things that I'd like to issues I'd like to discuss today. The way we approached this meeting was, I thought if we there's a couple of items that we need to figure out what we want to do with the bill, and so I've got we contacted a lot of local government folks that are right now on their assemblies, and we have three online. But we've talked to five, and I think this is a really important discussion because I want to make sure they have a voice because they're thinking of things that I wouldn't think of, and we've had some really good insights to the bill. Everybody's excited about the bill. What we're trying to do right now is just make sure there's no unintended consequences. And so one of the items that came up last time too is in the bill we kept what was in statute about a $75,000 exemption. And so if you exempt, approve a property tax exemption, the assembly does, they have to take a vote of the people for residential property exemptions. Commercial right now is not in the in statute. It's only for residential. And so I think that's going to be something really important to talk about. Do we want to remove that? Do we want to raise that? Do we want to include commercial? You could totally eliminate it. And so that's why I thought it was important to have local government people in the discussion. And I know the ones online have read the bill, and they have things to say. But they also here really are for you guys to ask questions and to see how that would affect their local government as well. There's also been a discussion around a grandfather clause. Right now, the way it's set up, they have to get approval from us from Juneau, and then they have to adopt it into their local ordinance. And so when I wrote the bill, I'm like, well, it's not going to affect any property exemptions that they have now. But I think there's just some concern to make sure that that's whatever was approved before stays in place. And so I'm open to that. And then, like I said, just a discussion around the $75,000 exemption as well. And so, and we have the Municipal League here, plus the folks online. So I hope you guys use the opportunity to ask them because they know better than I, you know, what would work for our local municipalities. This is really just a, I call it the free the municipality bill, so they don't have to come to us when they want a property tax exemption.
Thank you, Representative Cologne. I really appreciate this is a lot more work, working with folks outside of the building, and I appreciate that this is going to take a little time to work through, but we've got most of our morning this morning to talk about things, and I appreciate the folks that you've been able to get online to get things started off. So, yes, there are a number of folks available for invited testimony here today and questions. Why don't I just read who's here, and then you let me know where we want to start. Of course, we have Nils Andreasen from the Alaska Municipal League here in the room. We also have online Brett Roderman, a Fairbanks resident. Neil Steininger from the Juneau Assembly, Sandra Moeller, the Director of Division and Community and Regional Affairs from DCCED, Anna Brawley from the Anchorage Assembly, and Dan Nelson is the State Assessor from DCCED. Where shall we start?
Well, I think it would be great to get to the folks online from Juneau, Fairbanks, and I think, and Anchorage, they may need to do a disclosure. And any thoughts on the bill, they could start it off.
All righty. So let's go there.
You can start with Anna, if you'd like.
Assemblymember Brawley, are you ready to join us this morning and dive into this discussion on optional property tax exemptions?
Yeah, thanks, Madam Chair. This is Anna Brawley. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. For the record, my name is Anna Brawley. I am here in my capacity as an assembly member with Anchorage Assembly. I'm not speaking for the assembly. And I'll also mention that I'm mostly here for questions, but I can say that I have a decent understanding of our current exemptions. And then also I'll mention Mr. Nolan Clauda from the mayor's office. He had a talk like first thing in the morning, but he intends to join, I think, at about 8:30. So he would also be a good resource.
And Brett?
Thank you. Mr. Roderman, you want to put yourself on the record and introduce yourself?
Okay, yes. Brett Roderman here from the Fairbanks North Star Borough. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, well, thank you, Madam Chair. And yes, I'll also do a disclaimer. I'm here in my capacity. I'm not here to represent the Fairbanks North Star Borough nor the North Star Borough Assembly, but I have read over this bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions or concerns that you guys might have. Thank you.
And just for more context, you are a current assembly member in Fairbanks, correct?
That is correct. I am a current assembly member.
Understanding the hat you're wearing today, it's important for all of us as we're doing our business who we're speaking for. Mr. Steininger, good morning.
Good morning, Liz Neil Steininger. I'm a member of the City and Borough of Juneau Assembly, and similarly, I'm here to represent myself as an assembly member, but not represent necessarily the views of the Juneau Assembly or the City and Borough of Juneau.
Thank you very much. Thank you for joining us here this morning.
So unless there's questions, I was hoping maybe we could dive into the exemption to have Mr. Andreessen. He has some ideas on what we could do with that, and maybe people could have input. And what I'm talking about is on page 2, line 27, it says must be approved by the voters if the exclusion or exemption exceeds $75,000 for property. And so we need to figure out, do we want to keep that in there? Do we want to raise it? And do we want to include commercial? But Mr. Andreessen has some ideas about things we could do and maybe kick off the discussion.
Thank you, Representative Cologne.
I've got lots of questions, whatever.
Welcome back, Mr. Andreessen. We have got plenty of time this morning so that get into the discussion and not just zoom through things. So welcome to the committee. Please put yourself on record and share your thoughts of where we're at right now.
Yeah, thank you. For the record, Nils Andreessen, I'm the executive director of the Alaska Municipal League. It's great to have local government officials online as well. And I hope that the committee is able to ask them questions along the way. I know I've spoken before about this bill and some key kind of broad topics that we think areas to improve, make sure that there is clarity. And ultimately, that's what local governments are looking for from law. The clearer you can be, the kinder it is to cities and boroughs in Alaska. So I think to this question of, and really specifically as Representative Cologne mentioned around the $75,000 and the voter approval, we have to think about, you know, where did that $75,000 come from? What does it mean and to whom? And then we have to think about, too, if we're going to ask voters to have a role in deciding exemptions, when, how, where, what information do they need, and how do they measure kind of the total impact? I think for me, when I think of 75,000, it feels like a fairly arbitrary number. Certainly, it's got some history. This exemption's been around for a while. It's increased over time, but probably hasn't kept up with inflation. I think it was inflation adjusted a few years back. So that's a question, and maybe the state assessor has more information about the history of that 75,000. But it means something different to different people, right? If I own a $250,000 home, removing $75,000 from that assessed value is meaningful. If I own a $1.5 million home, it really isn't. So we have to think about why that exemption, who is it focused on? I imagine the focus, its intent is to really relieve those who are most vulnerable and who would experience the greatest burden of property tax. And for those who don't need it, is it just an add-on or a bonus to what they might otherwise pay? So we have to think about it in those terms. I think we have to think about optional exemptions generally and residential in particular. Residential is the largest of the optional exemptions that local governments have on their books. It's the largest a reduction of locally assessed values. And not all jurisdictions utilize it, but for those who do, it's important. So I think we have to understand it in the context of the total tax base, and then understand, I think, more broadly what happens with optional exemptions. And again, I think the state assessor can speak to this, but when it comes to local assessment, the optional exemptions are applied, and then when to determine the or to get to the full value determination, the state assessor brings those back in. And what that means is that it's only applied at the local level, and then when it is completed, the full value determination is completed by the state assessor. That affects education funding, and those things are related. I think the other element of that 75,000 that we're talking about is what is the impact on the mill rate? You could exempt at 75,000 for residential and have to increase the mill rate because the budget increases, and it has no net impact on the actual property. So I want us to kind of think about those things in relation, or the $75,000 optional residential exemption in relation to full value determination, in relation to who benefits from that exemption, and then ultimately, are they experiencing an actual benefit? Is it reduction in their assessed value, but still they pay more in property taxes because the mill rate went up? And the more that exemption is applied across the tax base, the higher the mill rate has to be to make up the difference. So it's complicated. And I imagine, again, that the state assessor can talk through that. I would offer that there's other ways to approach it, maybe. So $75,000 is a simple way, maybe, for voters to know, hey, my house is worth this much. I'm going to get a $75,000 exemption, and so I'm only taxed on this whatever is left over. That's an easy math calculation. I think what they don't see is that cumulative impact, how many others are benefiting from that exemption, and then what's that total exemption budget that the local government has. Optional exemptions are about 24. They reduce the local tax base by about 24%, which means that the mill rate has to be adjusted to make up for that difference. On top of mandatory exemptions, a total tax base reduction of just over 32%, roughly. Is that math right? Yes. So we've got to think about it in those terms as well. We've suggested that you could, instead of a $75,000, you can kind of think about what's a total exemption budget that each local government could have annually to adjust or total. So you could think about it in those terms. You could think about it as a percent of property, which would be maybe a more of kind of a sliding scale. If you've got a $250,000 home versus a $1.5 million home, $75,000 is a different percentage. But you could pick a percentage if the goal is to truly alleviate the assessed value experienced by different types of homeowners. So those are potentially mechanisms. We lose, or maybe not lose, but one of the things that you'd want to see in this bill is if you do pick a fixed number, how does that adjust over time so that we don't have to come back here next year and adjust it again, and the year after that and adjust it again. So thinking about how to allow for an inflation adjustment, either within the bill or allowing local governments to do that on their own, that's part of could be part of that local decision making that occurs. But those are, I think, specific to that $75,000 and how it's applied. Those are some, I guess, wide-ranging thoughts. And again, maybe encourage you to ask the state assessor for more more of the history related to where that number came from and how that works.
So, Mr. Andreasen, I want to go back a little bit. So my head's doing some math, and I understand some of these terms a little bit more than others. But basically, there's a certain amount of income a local government is looking to get from its property taxes. And the optional and mandatory exemptions just change the formula around. And ultimately, that number that you're looking to get from property taxes is the same. So these are just adjustments on factors for residential and commercial properties. One of the things that you said, though, was it affected the amount of money that could be collected for education. How does that not fit into that rest of that formula?
Yeah. So I think we have to understand exemption. Sorry, Co-Chair Mears. We have to understand all exemptions as cost shifting to other taxpayers, right? Local government has a budget. It determines that budget ahead of how much it needs to spend ahead of time, and then it looks at what's going to fund that budget. And so for those with the property tax, it turns to the property tax and it establishes a mill rate based on the total of that budget. Optional exemptions shift who pays that for that budget. And so if this is targeted at residential, it means that other types of taxpayers within the jurisdiction are making up a greater portion of the total tax burden. So it could be commercial properties, other types of properties that don't benefit from residential personal property, for instance. So that's being applied across your other tax payers. The assessor's job is to review the local assessed value, add back in the optional exemptions, add and ensure the real or personal property is in there, and make other adjustments to get to full and true value for each jurisdiction. It can be substantially more, almost by 50% in some communities, much less in most. The increase to get to full value determination. The full value determination isn't actually a function of Title 29. It's a function of the state education statutes. The reason to have a full value determination is that local governments have a required local contribution, an RLC, of 2.65 mils or equivalent of the full value determination that's required for them to contribute to education funding and make up some of the difference that the state might otherwise make up entirely where there's not a community with a property tax or a municipal school district. So that full value determination, no matter if there's an optional exemption or not, the full value determination requires each local government to tax at least for that 2.65 mils and apply it to the remaining, those who remain having a tax in place. So the optional exemption, sorry, this is the optional exemption applies on the front end to get to assessed value, but the tax is still applied. The tax has to increase based on the full value determination. So they're experiencing kind of a net increase potentially irrespective of the optional exemption. And actually, that full value determination has increased pretty substantially over the last few years. And so what you see is local governments making up an increasing share of the overall contribution to schools. And so even, for instance, the BSA went up just last year. There were some districts who experienced a loss of state revenue because the full value determination and the required local contribution was more than what the BSA made up for. So they work in a variety of ways, but I think for a taxpayer, what they're experiencing is, yes, the optional exemption, you know, is one shifting cost to others, but the mill rate has to go up and kind of meet the needs as determined by the full value determination and the budget. Ultimately, of the jurisdiction.
Thank you. I will need to let that sink in a little bit.
Me too.
Very impressive explaining that all in words. We've got some questions queuing up, but Representative Colon, did you have something to clarify?
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Mears, if I could add something to it. So this cost shifting that Nils is talking about, that is why it's required to go to a vote of the people, right? And so for us, and this is kind of what I want to hear from the local government, too, is should the state be telling them any of this, or should we try to control it because of the factors that he was talking about? Some of the people that I've talked to said just eliminate it from state statute. Let us deal with our own municipalities. And some would like it clearer and in a different, you know, context. But I think the biggest question is, do we, as from the state level, do we want to tell municipalities at this level you have to take it to the vote of the people? And if we determine that, yeah, we want to keep that in, then we need to figure out the formula and talk about all what he's talking about, the amount or the percentage or whatever we want to do with that. But I would at some point like to hear from the folks on the phone how they feel about that.
Thank you, Representative Colon. Hopefully we'll stick a little bit towards this question in front of us at the moment, but it's committee. We'll
of
see
course.
Where things go.
Of
and I've
course.
Got Representative Himshue, Representative Prox, oh, Representative Holland.
Good for now.
For the moment. Coach okay. Himshue.
Well, I have a lot of questions, and they're going in a lot of directions. So I'm going to start really basic through the co-chair to Mr. Andreasen. Maybe I'm from the only town that does this, and I'm hoping you'll know, but our mill rate is in our charter. To change our mill rate is a vote of the people. So when I heard about places where they set the mill rate and it adjusts with what the schools need, I just am blown away by that. So is Sitka the only place where our mill rate is a vote of the people that you know of?
Co-chair Himshue, through the chair. That explains a lot of what I hear from Sitka. I don't know that it's unique, but it is unusual. I will say that. As budgets are set, it's the budget that determines how much revenue is needed, not how much revenue is available determines the budget. That's how it occurs in, I think, most local governments. So the local government evaluates what services are required by residents, what kind of maintenance needs do we have, what other goods, improvements, et cetera, do we need to make. They determine here's what that dollar value looks like. They look at their available revenues. And I think most are moving toward myriad revenues. So it's an inclusion of sales tax and bed tax and so on, as well as the property tax. Property tax, for those who have it, is the majority of most revenues. And they set the mill rate on what's left between, you kind of reduce out what you're expecting from other revenues, and then the mill rate is adjusted based on it. And so every year that mill rate is adjusted based on what's necessary to fund the government based on expected needs. Okay. Also, I'm not commenting on City and Borough of Sitka's charter or governance model or taxation generally.
And of course, there's other things going on there. For example, Anchorage just got a cap. Right. So, there's other things that adjust in there too.
Charters are interesting animals.
Thank you. Co-Chair Himshue, follow-up?
Yeah, I'll have a lot of follow-ups, so at some point just cut me off. But also to Mr. Andreasen, when we first started on this bill, you said there was a distinction between home rule and general rule in terms of their powers to set exemptions, I think. So could you talk a little more about that and maybe give us a sense of how many of Alaska's municipalities are home rural versus general, if you know that?
Yeah. So there's, I think, about 20, Representative Himshu through the chair, approximately 20 local governments that are home rule. The rest are general law or second class general law. The distinction, home rule, governments can do anything that their charter allows, anything that's not prohibited in law. And for general law municipalities, they're only allowed to do what's in law. And I think... I wish that home. I've argued with others about this in the past. I think a wish of mine that I want to believe that home rule governments could do whatever exemption they want to. But I think because in statute it says a municipality may, it automatically precludes home rule governments from doing anything beyond what's in that statute. So there's a lot of leeway in within the optional exemptions to some extent, but they still need the legislature to. Enable a kind of a greater ability for them to make choices that are consistent with their interests. I think it's still a limiting factor.
Okay. I'll do one more follow-up.
One more, and then we'll go to Representative Pratt. There will be more opportunities. Yeah. But
thank you for that. Through the co-chair, I would welcome a conversation with Dan Nelson about the full value determination. You kind of explained how that worked to us. I'd like to hear it more from him. And I'm not sure if my question is for him or for Mr. Andreasen, but at one point the state was reimbursing for at least the senior property tax exemption. Do you know anything about the history of that? When did we stop reimbursing, and did we always reimburse at 100%?
Yeah. Representative Himshute through the chair. And it's important to note that with regard to the full value determination, optional exemptions get added back in. Mandatory exemptions do not. So they stay out of the full value determination. The senior citizen property tax exemption, the disabled vet property exemption, I think it's been around since 85. Roughly 95, 97 is when the state stopped making payments. There were a few years when it was partial, and then I think it hasn't been in place since 97. But I would have to go back to the Alaska taxable that Dan produces to be clear.
Quick comment.
Yes.
I want to clarify that I'm understanding that right. So the state says you must make this exemption, and we will not pay you back for it.
Right. Through the chair. That's correct. We're not... the law says you must, the state must, and the budget says there's no money for it. So it's an appropriating function of the legislature versus a policy or legal aspect. I will say that the mandatory exemption, the value of that senior exemption right now is about $100 million, $15 billion in of the tax base. It's increased dramatically over the last few years. Our senior population continues to grow. There's more and more seniors who are benefiting from that exemption. And again, all exemptions are cost shifting. So that $100 million in exemption, basically cash that's not being collected from seniors, is being collected elsewhere within the tax base.
Or in Sitka, not.
Or if you've got a charter that, yes.
Okay. And I'd love to hear from Dan Nelson now or later. If folks have questions for Mr. Andreasen, we could. I just need to understand more how the full value determination is set at some point.
Thank you, Coach Hamshute. I'd like not to stray too far from the $75,000 question, as we do have some assembly members online that. Yeah, I think want to contribute on that. Representative Proxy, you're next in the queue.
I
want to stray.
Maybe.
That's all right. Representative Proxy, you have the floor.
I think it might be better overall to continue with Rep. Henschutz's line of question. I'll wait. I'm happy to wait. Because it's taxes. How do you cheat the other guy and pass savings on to me?
How do you invest in your community?
I don't think so. I think it's how do you cheat the other guy. But it will be complicated. Let's try one at a time. So please.
All righty, then. Let's then go to Mr. Nelson, our state assessor. Are you ready to jump in, or shall we rephrase some of our queries?
Through the chair, Dan Nelson, state assessor. I do have some history on that $75,000 exemption prior to 1973. According to AS 29.53.025A, municipalities could exclude or exempt or partially exempt residential property from taxation ratified by the voters at a regular or special election. That exemption at the time would have allowed the exemption of any amount of for residential property to the Office of the State Assessor. To their knowledge at the time, there were no records of any municipality taking advantage of this exemption. However, in 1973, the law was changed and capped. I'm not certain what bill it was, but it was capped at $10,000. And then in 2004, SB 136 was introduced and increased it to $50,000. And it was actually reduced to $20,000 and was effective for the 25 tax year. Not certain when it was adjusted to the $75,000. That was after 2011.
I seem to about remember that. Representative Hemshire, you want to follow up?
If I may.
Please do.
Thank you. Through the co-chair to Mr. Nelson. So the state was reimbursing up until 1997. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Dan Nelson, state assessor. It appears that, let me, one second. It looks like the program costs exceeded funding levels from the state in 1996 and resulted in prorating payments to eligible municipalities. The Alaska legislature has not funded the reimbursement since 1997. That is for the 65 years or older and disabled veteran tax exemption.
Sir Andreasen,
if I may jump in.
Representative Prox.
Yes. Thank you. My understanding of the statute is that the state mandates the exemption for residential property. But the weasel wording is subject to appropriation. The legislature may fund it. And we haven't done that because we're not required to. But it's important because this is all deception and it's really easy to get confused. So does that make... Have I got that correct, Mr. Assessor?
Maybe point of clarification. No, Co-Chair Mears, to Representative Prox, and I think in general. So there's two conversations going on right now. So I just want to be clear. So the first had to do, and I think State Assessor Nelson talked about the history of the residential exemption, the optional residential exemption, and where that $75,000 came from. So 1968, is that what he said? With a number actually being in place after 1973 or so. It's worth noting that that's kind of closely corresponds to the development of Prudhoe, right? So there was an enabling legislation, and then there were numbers added later when it made sense, once a revenue from petroleum became a reality. So there's that conversation, and then separately, and I think the second question that Mr. Nelson responded to had to do with the mandatory exemption for senior citizens and disabled vet And that's the one that is where the state is required in statute to reimburse local governments for it. But there's no requirement for the state to reimburse optional exemptions, and including the residential.
Representative Prox.
Yes, so then I was not completely correct. Is the state mandated to reimburse for the mandatory part of the property tax exemption for seniors and disabled veterans?
Representative Prox, yes. Okay. The mandatory, but not the optional residential.
Thank you, Mr. Andreasen.
Can I clarify?
Representative Cologne. I'm thinking of one and looking at the other.
So the mandatory exemptions the state is reimbursing?
No, it's supposed to, but doesn't.
Right. Okay, thank you.
Subject to appropriation.
And Co-Chair Mayors, if I could just add, this was a lot of conversations in the interim. The bill does not touch the mandatory exemption, unless you guys want it to, but I really didn't feel like I wanted to get in that deep. The bill is only addressing the optional exemptions that the state did not promise to reimburse. It's just the optional exemptions for local municipalities.
Could I add to that? Sorry.
Mr. Andreasen.
Co-Chair Mir, sorry. I think it's worth knowing, and I haven't said this on the record before, but it's worth knowing that these are all stackable. Right, so you get the mandatory exemption, you get a senior exemption, and then you get a residential exemption, and then you get whatever else you might qualify for. So it's that total exempted value actually that ends up decreasing potentially your tax bill. So that's just worth knowing that these aren't kind of one-offs. They're stackable and they don't replace one another at all.
Co-Chair Hampshire.
Oh, I just wanted to make sure I'm understanding this correctly. The bill doesn't address the mandatory, which is disabled veterans and seniors. However, I have to get out of my Sitka mindset on this, but those are required. They're going to happen, and so your available revenue is going to be lower in your community because the state is not reimbursing. So it plays a role in our consideration of the legislation, even though you're not touching it with the legislation.
Correct. I guess the real discussion is, do you want municipalities to weigh those changes, or do you want them to have to come to us to get permission to do that? So, and that's why I had the local government people here, because they know that. They know that the state's not reimbursing that. And so it's really up to the assemblies to say, well, we have this loss of revenue. Should we do this another exemption? How does that affect our budget? My bill is trying to do is get us out of the middle and let local governments try to make those decisions on their own.
So, follow-up? Thank you, through the chair. I think my question is for Representative Cologne, but it could be for Neil Steininger. Mm-hmm. If the state is no longer involved and saying what can and can't be an optional exemption, then community members could get together and say, we want to exempt whatever up to $75,000. So you could have a citizens initiative that says, we're going to exempt. So something I've thought about a lot is our senior population has gone up to 20%+ in my community, mm-hmm. and we're really struggling to get young families there. So as much as we want to support our seniors, a property tax exemption for the young families could be better placed in terms of what our community needs for its growth and sustainability. So what would stop the voters from saying, we are going to make a property tax exemption for everybody under the age of 30, and then putting that initiative out into the universe without the state having a role? I don't mean if that's what voters want. Yeah.
So I'll start and I'll pass it over. So actually that came up when we talked to the Matsu folks. It's the first thing they brought up. And so I know my staff has worked on an amendment to try to, because that was something we didn't really consider, but we're talking with Matsu. We understand, as far as I understand it, and maybe Mr. Steininger can chime in, that the bill doesn't really stop that. And so I think it is something we need to address in the bill, unless I'm not understanding it correctly. But it's already come up. We've already discussed it quite a bit and trying to make sure that citizen initiative, what does that look like? But I think an approval for a citizen initiative by the local government might be an option before it goes. Or there's a couple of different options, but it's interesting you brought that up because it came up from the Matsu folks too.
Quick follow-up.
I'll follow up.
And, you know, maybe Sitka's unique, but we've put our property tax, we've tried to increase our mill rate multiple times in Sitka, and we've tried to exchange it for a sales tax on food, take that off to support families and increase our mill rate. And we cannot get it done. When you ask the voters, do you want to pay more tax? The answer is no.
Right.
And yet the needs, the services that they request are, you know, reasonable. People want certain services, but the connection between those services and, anyway, so now I'm going off and making comments.
Well, I think it's an uncoupled argument, too. It's like, it's not, do you want to pay more taxes? In reality, it's like, where do you want that to happen? But that's not part of the conversation that gets out there. Mr. Andreessen.
Yeah, and I would appreciate hearing from Mr. Steininger too, but I would say in that circumstance, so that's part of the elegance of this bill is if a local government wanted to exempt new homeowners or young people under 30 or, you know, pick a thing, they would have to come to the legislature right now and ask for you to enter, you know, go through this process to get to an optional exemption to add it into the long list of other optional exemptions that are already in statute. And it would be fine-tuned and specific, and there wouldn't be much flexibility, and we would do that again and again and again for every new type of exemption that we could dream up. What this bill does is say, all right, we want local governments to lead that process and make decisions that are consistent with the needs of their community. So if we have a community with a high growing senior population and we're having a hard time attracting young professionals, then we're going to spend some policy time on attracting young professionals. So that's what this bill does. In the case of a citizens initiative or public pressure or anything, that would become part of you know, any of the challenges with any exemption process. And ultimately, a mill rate will go up, unless you have locked your mill rate into your charter, in which case you will forego services, you will not have deferred revenue budget, deferred maintenance budget, you will not be able to fund schools to the cap. All of those things will happen. It will put competing pressure on other things that you might do. But for everybody else, mill rates would go up in response to citizens acting for one exemption or another. And that's the public education that needs to happen within communities. What is the effect of any exemption? Who's going to bear the burden of a tax increase on the other side because needs don't go away? And we need to design, and I think this bill, you know, lays some good groundwork for how can a local government manage that process in some kind of responsible way without having to come back to the legislature every time there's a new idea for an additional exemption.
Hence our discussion on clarity, yet looking for unintended consequences in our discussion here today. Representative Brox.
Thank you. Just through the chair to clarify, is it Mr. Nelson, the assessor, the total assessed value calculated by the state assessor includes property that has non-mandatory exemptions.
Just a clarification. Is that correct? It's not necessarily the state assessor. There's local assessors as well.
Well, that's where this gets more complicated.
By the assessor in general. Mr. Nelson.
Yeah.
Through the chair, Dan Nelson, State Assessor. Representative Prox, could you restate that question, please?
Yes. You, the State Assessor, have to calculate the total taxable value, I think it's called, for the 2.26 mil imposed by the state to pay for education. I think I understood Mr. Andreessen to say that the value, the mandatory exemption that the state imposes on municipalities is subtracted from the total assessed value of the municipality. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Prox, Dan Nelson, State Assessor, that is correct. I do add back in the Office of the State Assessor does add back in the optional exemption, and then we also bring it up to full and true value, 100% value, so that we are comparing apples to apples with all jurisdictions for the real property analysis portion.
Yes, follow up. Does the state assessor just take all of the assessments that are made by the local tax assessor and just add all those together, and is that the number that you use, or do you make some sort of different assessment for total assessed value for the municipality?
Through the chair, Representative Prax, Dan Nelson, State Assessor, we use their assessed values and also add in personal property. That includes vehicles, airplanes, boats, inventory, and machinery and equipment. And we do look at both what has been reported and analyze if it's appropriate values.
And in the personal property part of that, you catch essentially registered vehicles, but do you make some sort of an assessment of the other personal property? If someone has the furniture. In the North Star Borough, personal property, as far as I know, is not taxed. But the state is adding personal property to the total assessed value of the borough. But do you then include personal property within somebody's residence?
Through the chair, Representative Prax, Dan Nelson, State Assessor, it's business inventory and business equipment.
Okay.
And then also boats and airplanes that are private and vehicles. The goal of the full value determination is to not determine what is taxable, what is taxed, but what is could be taxable, the maximum amount taxable.
Follow up?
Senator Prox, we're straying a little far here.
Well, we are. I agree.
I'm with him, though.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because if the municipality relies on sales tax, I think that's only the only option. But the municipality, like in the case of Sitka, that's interesting that the mill rate is set by charter. So if the municipality set the property tax at zero, the municipality would have to come up with some sort of other tax to pay the minimum local contribution for schools. Is that correct? I don't know if that happens, but... Well, there's many small municipalities that don't charge any property tax. So how would they come up with the minimum school tax?
Mr. Nelson?
Through the chair, Representative Prax, we do an analysis and do come up with those jurisdictions that have a school district with no property tax, but we do, the Office of the State Assessor does come up with those values for assessed values for the jurisdictions that do have a school district and no property tax. That is included in our full value determination.
And follow up?
Are we about done here, Representative Prox?
Well, yep.
Okay, thank you.
The state, the state assessor, then has to do the assessment for the properties if the local government doesn't have an assessing department. Is that true?
Mr. Nelson?
Through the chair, Representative Prox, Dan Nelson, that is correct. Dan Nelson, state assessor, that is correct.
Okay, I won't follow up on the next one, but that's... How in the world do they do that?
There'll be more. Representative Holland.
Thanks. Through the chair, I have just one short question for Mr. Nelson on where we were, but then I want to get to a broader question for the municipalities and the folks we might have online here, because I want to go back to the balcony on this thing to figure out where we're here, where we're going with this. But Mr. Nelson, if you could just clean up one small little point. As you look around the state and gather up all of this property value information, is there any adjustment that is considered for the local cost of living or disposable income of folks? I would imagine that a house that's worth $500,000 in Anchorage is quite different than a house that's in rural Alaska that might have cost $500,000, and the ability of people to pay and make local contribution in terms of the local income, it seems like it'd be very varied. How do you, or do you at all, when you're doing this statewide roll-up of property, account for local cost of living and any adjustment to the values that you've determined?
Mr. Nelson?
Through the chair, Representative Holland, Dan Nelson, state assessor, yes, we do take that into account. It's in our market analysis. We're trying to come up with the market value for each market area. So that's why we would have a different value from Anchorage versus Kenai.
Okay, thanks. So if I could, I'd like to go back out to the balcony, I think, with some of the representatives from the different municipalities or cities here. And I really want to go, you know, probably up to 60,000 feet to ask them, what do you like and not like about this current bill? What's it doing? What's it not doing that you think is relevant that we should be talking about? And more particularly, I'm really curious what you think the state's role is that's beneficial, and where is it not beneficial for the state to have any involvement in any of this property tax discussion? Because I'm compelled with the idea of why are we even doing all this? But I'm also compelled to think that maybe you have some reasons to think that maybe you want the state to set some boundaries to create fairness and transparency. So two questions for any of the folks that would like to. What do you like and not like about the bill? And what do you like and not like about the state having a role in guiding property tax exemptions?
We're going to, Coach Hampshire wants a quick question before we go there, and then just for our assembly members online, we'll go in the order we did intros, Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, just to be simple.
I only wanted to comment, it would be great to have retired assembly members. The political risk to a sitting assembly member on their comments on this bill, I think, is not small. So I just wanted to say, I hope folks can find a way to thread that needle, because if you say you don't want the voters to decide, that's a terrible thing to ever say. And yet sometimes in our seats, you know, in Sitka, the Assembly got rid of our senior sales tax exemption because we saw the top-heavy population of seniors, and the Assembly made the very hard choice to get rid of our senior sales tax exemption. That did not land well, and an initiative by the seniors put it back. And so, and those, a lot of folks had political repercussions from that. So anyway, I appreciate these Assembly members being here today and talking openly about, as openly as they are willing to talk about the bill.
To the chair, I think that point is very well made. So to the degree that there's some comments that can be offered that are helpful, thank you. To the degree that this is kind of a hard, complex issue, that's why I'm asking, but I would also understand why maybe we can't get all of it out there, and I'd look forward to just learning more about this issue. Thank you.
Let's start with Assembly Member Brawley.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and lots of good questions and discussion today. So again, my name is Anna Brawley, speaking again as my capacity as an Assembly member, but not for the Assembly. I'll address Representative Holland's questions and just provide some other information. So in terms of what I like or don't like about this bill, I will say the Assembly has not taken a position on this particular bill. We've certainly done a lot of work on policy. We've taken a position on a different bill, and I think the general principle of increasing local control is something that our municipalities weighed on. So I would say I'm speaking in the confines of that. Also, I'll say in general, I think it's important to remember that property tax historically is really about taxation of land, with the idea that if you own land in a city, or if you're living on someone else's land, right, and you're paying it through rent, that is what you're paying for. You're paying for the services to maintain the value of that land, physical access to that land, law enforcement or public safety services, fire services that maintain the value of that property. And of course, we typically have structures on the property. So I just want to bring it back to that. And much of our city budget is really tied to maintaining that physical infrastructure and paying for the people and the services that maintain that. The roads, parks, facilities, again, fire, if your house burns down, at least for those in a fire service area, that is what it's for, right? So we certainly can have good policy discussions about how much property should be paying, and, you know, what mix of taxation who pays for local government. That's a good one. So I'm not arguing that property tax is the only way or the best way, but historically that is one of the major ways. And of course, schools as well, that's been talked about. I'll mention, we have a separate property tax collection cap in Anchorage. So instead of a mill rate cap, we actually have a property tax collection cap, and it's a formula. And so, if you get to the same place where it constrains the growth of government or the growth of the budget, but from a different angle. So I'll mention that. I'll also mention general, our trend is that residential property assessments have been going up while our commercial assessments have been pretty much flat. And I think that really reflects market trends. We see post-COVID, we're having changing work patterns, right? You know, retail is in flux. All of those kind of things that really mean commercial property is not at a huge premium right now, at least not in Anchorage. But also we have a chronic lack of building new housing, and so all the housing that's there keeps increasing in value. So I also want to note, if you're hearing a lot of pressure to Representative Hinshute's point about kind of, why are we paying so much or how much we're looking at property tax, I think it's important to remember it is because more and more residents are paying that because of the cost shifting if one type of assessment's going up and the other's flat. In terms of what I like and don't like in the bill, I would say one thing I would caution as far as any changes to the mandatory exemptions, and I appreciate Representative Kulal mentioned that they removed the kind of changes to the senior exemption. It looks like disabled debt is still in there. I would say not so much, do I like that or not, but if that happens, I think probably there is still a lot of public interest in maintaining those exemptions. So I would encourage a delayed implementation date or effective date, at least for some of those sections, because I imagine if they are removed in state suit, then basically that would not exist unless a municipality adopts it into their local code. And of course, if that does require a public vote, then there would need to be time to do that. So that I would just flag that as a consideration of when these would take effect, especially if it's touching anything that already exists, and that would be true for the other optional exemptions. And then lastly, I just wanted to comment on the 75,000 cap. That's one area that I think, again, I don't know what the right number is, but I want to back up from that and just give the committee some things to think about. And really in the space of the voter approval question, I think Representative Tim Shannon Prox alluded to this. Really the caution I would give is, or the consideration really is, how much to think about taxation and budget policy as a political decision, because that's really what it is. It says that the voters are going to decide either on a broad policy, you know, how much should we allow exemption, and or for potentially a specific property or a specific project, you know, is that what goes to voters? So I think, you know, in our charter, for example, the people are required to vote on any sales tax. There isn't a similar requirement for other types of taxes in our charter, but of course that's that is the structure we have. But I would say for the property tax exemptions, I would encourage thinking about two different types. One is that you qualify if you're an individual, and as long as you meet those qualifications, you could have that basically, you know, forever or for the rest of your life, essentially. So if you're a senior, if you're a disabled veteran, if you're a resident, you're occupying your own property, all of those are really conditions of the individual, and it's easier to set a dollar amount there. However, it gets more complicated when you're talking about time-limited economic project-based exemptions, which is what a lot of the exemptions are actually in Anchorage, trying to encourage more housing. So I think I would say as a general principle, you know, people are always going to vote for their own financial benefit, and then it becomes much more uncertain if you're asking them to vote on a financial benefit for other people. I think that's just a general principle. Again, doesn't mean it's good or bad to require a vote. But I would say, you know, as an example, if there's an economic development exemption available, this is my last comment, let's say one property could qualify for it, and then the total value that they would get per year is $50,000, then that would argue they would not go to a public vote. If that same exemption is used for a much larger property, like the same policy but a different individual project, and let's say it's, you know, $200,000 or $500,000 because it's a major redevelopment of an entire area for multifamily housing, for example, then it really kind of politicizes that project potentially to a degree that we don't normally see in land use and development. You know, I think there's property rights considerations, there's due process considerations, and our development codes really lay out a clear public process, at which point, you know, the people are not the final decider on that. It is our CFO, or in the planning sense, it's our, you know, Planning and Zoning Commission. And so I would really caution thinking about those kinds of projects and maybe separating them, because I don't think we'd want to see basically a developer having to run a campaign, a public campaign, on the ballot to ask if we should give an exemption to build more housing, because I think that really can complicate and create a lot of really, again, due process issues and more uncertainty. And I think a lot of what we're trying to do is make development more certain. Doesn't mean that it happens in all cases, but that could run contrary to those goals. So those are the things that I would flag. Happy to take other questions, but just some things to think about how these can be used, at least in Anchorage.
Thank you, Assemblymember Brawley. Let's go up to Fairbanks to Assemblymember Rodemund with your personal hat on here today. Back to Representative Holland's question about basically what you like and what you don't like.
Okay, yeah, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak. Just to remind everybody, I am speaking in my own capacity. I'm not here to represent the Fairbanks North Shore Borough nor the North Shore Borough Assembly, but I would say that I would agree with almost everything that the Assembly member from Anchorage said. You know, as you guys consider this bill, Fairbanks is a little bit different. You know, we have a second-class borough, so we have very limited powers. Within that second-class borough, we have two home rule cities, and so I believe that's probably pretty unique. So what I like about this bill is, you know, anything that returns power and decision making to the local body, I'm always in favor of. As I understand the history, if I'm correct, the history of how this was set up years ago was that, you know, our, many years ago, our boroughs were in their infancy, you know. You know, to me, 1980 seems like yesterday, but in 1980, the Fairbanks North Shore Borough was about 15 years old. So I could kind of understand how the state would want to have a little bit more control over this, but, you know, I believe our boroughs and our municipalities now, you know, they have much better staff involved. We've got a history. We certainly know, you know, what's going on here at the local level. But as always, whenever you pass, you allow any kind of an exemption, for us anyway, as our mill rate adjusts based on our budget and what we're able to bring in with our tax cap, because we also have a tax cap that's based on a formula, and the bulk of that formula is based on new construction and new assessed value that's brought into the borough, along with the, you know, the consumer price index and some other factors. Anytime you pass any kind of exemption, you're passing the buck on to the other taxpayers. So just recently, we passed a tax incentive for new construction, primarily because we're expecting an influx of military workers here, and we don't have much housing. So we're trying to incentivize our contractors to build more family homes so that can be either purchased or rented by the military. So, you know, these tax exemptions are great. And, you know, hopefully it will spur on some development here. But as with anything, we've passed that cost on to the rest of the taxpayers because our mill rate adjusts accordingly. So, those are just some initial thoughts on there, and I'm happy to circle back around. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now let's jump down here to Juneau, Assemblymember Steininger.
Hello, Neil Steininger with the City and Borough of Juneau Assembly. And again, I'm speaking for myself and not necessarily the views of the Assembly as a whole here in Juneau. So in Juneau, we're kind of undergoing a bit of a sea change in our financial systems and our revenue collection. We recently had a ballot initiative that limited our mill rate to 9 mills, down from a mill rate cap of 12 mills, and that's similar to Sitka has said in the charter. So we do have that limitation, as well as a pretty significant change to exemptions for our sales tax. And so as we've been looking at how to address kind of that gap between what our recurring budget had been in the past and now what our recurring revenues are going to be, we're looking a lot at the exemptions that we currently have set in city code. A lot of those exemptions that we have right now are sales tax exemptions that we may be looking at possibly removing or amending. And as I look at this bill and think about kind of some of those, you know, public purposes behind our existing sales tax exemptions, you know, a bill like this provides some flexibility for us to think about if we need to remove a sales tax exemption that may be exempting, you know, more revenue than we can now afford to exempt, having more tools to kind of create more finer definition on exemptions that may try to address the same public policy goals that we have could be beneficial as we have this conversation as a community. So that's definitely to address Mr. Holland's question, or Representative Holland's question. You know, that's definitely a piece of this bill that I like, is that it's providing a little more nuance to local governments to address, you know, specific local policy goals as we work through our budgets locally. Regarding the, you know, question of the $75,000 limit, I think my thoughts on that are really similar to Assemblymember Brawley from Anchorage. You know, thinking about the places where you might have an exemption there that's larger than $75,000, you know, might be, you know, a large development of many multifamily or single-family housing units within a large development. and the risk of politicizing or just slowing the feedback loop of being able to provide that incentive to build housing. I think we're not unique here in Juneau in the need to develop new residential housing, and looking at the different tools that we have, you know, something that would can prevent or make it harder to provide that incentive to a developer could create challenges. You know, that said, you know, Representative Hinshu kind of spoke to the citizen initiative process of bringing of this, opening it up to allow citizen initiatives to come forward and put some of these property tax exemptions in. You know, that's definitely something that we would think about here in the community. Our charter provides very broad authority to citizens to bring forward initiatives and referendums. I think that's a, you know, kind of community value here in Juneau that we have. And so, you know, thinking about how something could be crafted in this bill that might limit that power would definitely be something that we'd have to see and understand to consider how that intersects with community values here in Juneau in terms of those powers that we've granted to the people in our charter. So I think it's another area where, you know, the local control within local government of people in communities like Juneau that have the powers that we do, you know, is something that we always want to kind of keep an eye on actions by the state that may limit those local powers that we are currently used to, I guess, is kind of what I would say to that. But otherwise, generally speaking, I think it's a positive thing to try to move towards allowing more nuanced control over property tax exemptions that we can apply here in our community to try and achieve specific Juneau public policy community goals.
Thank you very much for that. I appreciate all the assembly members chiming in. Representative Holland, do you have any follow-ups on that?
I do. I'm not sure how to go there because this may be – I want this to be a short question, but I'm not sure how it'll go. We've had a lot of discussion here about residential property, and the responses that we just got, I think, are really helpful. But also it opens up the question of how do we differentiate residential property and exemptions that are affiliated with large commercial projects and the benefits that come from commercial developers as a business, and to some degree residential property is a business versus residential property that's owner-occupied. And to the degree that we're providing property exemptions for a person living in the house to help incentivize that is one thing. And I'm just generally, though, curious about, we've had a lot of discussion about residential property exemptions, and I'm assuming there's a whole separate world of commercial property exemptions that don't seem to be included here. So I guess two parts to the question, and then I'll put a cork in it. I'm curious, and maybe Mr. Andreasen can clarify, what's the total value of exemptions that are being given for residential property versus being given for commercial property? And how should we be thinking about this exemption issue with regard to commercial residential property that is developed by commercial interests? And Mr. Andreasen, if you can just kind of frame the residential versus commercial just in the big picture, and I don't know if anybody else wants to chime in on how to think through this thing, but it's gotten much more complicated in the last hour, hour and a half. So I appreciate your indulgence.
Representative Holland, through the chair. Dan, is this the question I asked you in email this morning? I don't know if you can answer that. What is that difference between residential and commercial exemptions? There's not data that we have that shows that. We know that residential is the largest optional exemption. The economic development exemption was just recently added, so it could be that commercial properties are increasingly being benefiting from that, but we don't. I don't have the most recent data. I think what's probably important in response to the question is what this bill does is remove the 75,000 and the voter approval was on residential and now is on real, Right. So it makes it on everything, which would be residential, commercial, all the exemptions that are out there related to property. So that's really big. That's a big difference, right? So we should be clear about that. And I think the other way I would answer that is really to build on Assemblymember Brawley's comments about, you know, it's one thing to vote on an exemption that applies to you and to all your neighbors, and it's another that you're voting on an exemption that only applies to a few. And maybe that's one way to kind of break this, provide additional clarity within this bill. It could be that for all real property exemptions that apply to all property owners in a jurisdiction, those go to a vote of the people. When there's a policy decision that a local government is advancing, that's when you get into a more, instead of a dollar number, you get into it goes to a vote of the people if it gets to a percentage of total property value in a jurisdiction or affects the mill rate by more than 10% or something like that. That could be kind of one way to set some guardrails without overcomplicating things. This is not in response to your question, but the other thing that came out of some of those comments had to do with mentioned there was a conversation about the Citizens Initiative, and I shouldn't comment on it, I want to say, and I don't have my constitution with me, that the power of taxation shall never be surrendered. And I wonder if there's an instance here where political subdivisions are being placed in that position of surrendering the power of taxation to residents, whether in charter or otherwise, that really we maybe should be careful about. And if we need guardrails to address that, then ultimately what you want is a local government to continue to be able to provide the services that it's required to by the Constitution, required to by state law, required to by its charter and its people, and so on. And those are political conversations that are informed by public comment and by voting, but they really need to reside within a jurisdiction that's got governing authority. And I don't know how to do that, and I'm not commenting on the value or not of citizens' initiatives, but I will place, just some a high level of concern on where that could really undermine the ability of a local government to do its job.
Thank you very much. I think maybe... Mr. Nelson, did you have a comment back to Mr. Andreas in calling you out about your earlier conversation?
Through the chair, Dan Nelson, state assessor. Yes, I did hear that. It depends on how it's been, if it's identified as commercial or industrial. But looking at our optionally exempt commercial real property, approximately 363 million is exempt, and looking at residential, we have about 6.7 billion that is exempt value, and that is exempt.
That's a big difference.
6.7 is what I heard.
I'm sorry, through the chair, Mr. Nelson, can you just repeat and confirm, was that 6.7 billion residential compared to 363 million commercial?
Correct. Preliminary numbers that I've calculated. It all depends on how the jurisdictions have classified their commercial versus industrial. So it could be, we could add industrial as well to the commercial properties. It all depends, but this is strictly how it has been identified and categorized as commercial in their annual reports that I receive.
Thank you, so Mr. Andreas, and I think you need to change your language in there. It's not just the largest. Representative Holland.
Thank you. Just a quick clarification through the chair to Mr. Nelson. With your last comment, can you clarify, is industrial currently included in that commercial number, or are you saying that industrial is a separate category that is not included in either of these numbers? for clarification, just.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Holland, Dan Nelson, State Assessor. This is strictly commercial property that has been classified by the local jurisdiction as commercial.
Senator Holland.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. But for clarification, is that to say there is another category of industrial that's not reported and we don't know, have a number for that? Or is it because industrial is currently lumped into commercial? I'm still trying to get clarity on, is industrial another number we don't have, or is it part of the commercial number?
Through the chair, Representative Holland, yes, I did not have the industrial number added to that commercial number.
Thank you.
Thank you. We've got a couple more folks in the queue. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Great discussion, and I also appreciate, and I mean, I think that the best decisions and the ramifications are made by the people closest to where the money comes in and goes out, notwithstanding some of your points as well, which I think are well made. My question is for the members online, and I think this is just, well, I'll ask the same question in two ways. Is there any particular exemption that, you know, going back to the spirit and the goal of this law, is there something that you guys have pursued in the past, either factually and had to come to the state to ask for, or is there something right now that you're precluded from doing as far as looking for an exemption that this law is stopping at the state level, if that makes sense?
We've had a couple come through committee, but I'll go to the... Yeah. The assembly members first. Assembly Member Brawley, you want to take that on first?
Yeah, thank you, through the chair, Representative. Assembly Member Brawley, to the committee question. I think one answer is, of course, if we wanted to pursue, for example, a larger residential exemption. I don't know of a project that we have done that. We increased. When the state allowed it to increase from $50,000 to $75,000, that was put to voters for statute. So I think, hypothetically, if we wanted to look at doing that further, then this would limit that, but I'm not speaking about a specific project. Otherwise, I think it's clear that the section in the current law that talks about economic development exemptions is the most broad, and so I believe, generally speaking, at least from the municipality, in the past, that's where the justification is, for example, we need more workforce housing or we need to improve deteriorated areas. And so those have an economic development component. But I can't speak to a specific idea that we've had that we've said, oh, gosh, we can't do that in state statute, if that makes sense.
Thank you. Mr. Rotermund.
Yes, so Brett Rotermund, with the North Star Borough, Fairbanks North Star Borough Assembly. So the only one I can think of recently, which is kind of coincidental with this bill, is a farm exemption, farm proper building exemption that we just passed, and I believe that was just a resolution, and then that had to go forth to the state. So that's the only one that recently comes to mind where this current law could have gotten in the way. Thank you.
Thank you, Assembly Member Steininger.
Neil Steininger, CBJ Assembly. My tenure on the Assembly is fairly short at this point, a little less than 2 years. So nothing during my time on the Assembly has been impeded by the current law.
Yeah, thank you. I'm sure there are examples, Madam Co-Chair, and maybe we can talk about offline just some historic examples of where municipalities have had to come before the state to request those kind of exemptions. I think would be helpful context.
Just last week?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Representative Elam's bill for changing the value of the optional property tax exemption is an example. We also had a bill come through last year. It's over on the Senate side now from Representative Gray that more finally dialed in some of those economic development concerns so that there was clarity there rather than using that general term. It looks like Mr. Andreasen might also have some
to contribute. Yeah, Representative Nelson, through the chair. I think, so I've heard a few things. So one, I mean, Assemblymember Brawley kind of mentioned the economic development exemption broadly construed and applicable. That's the kind of language that I think is useful in state statute. I mean, if you kind of wanted to set guardrails around how optional exemptions are implemented, you could say, you know, for the purposes of community and economic development, right? And that's when, you know, local governments can do a lot with that. And sometimes that's not enough. So there's a lot of, I think, wrangling between municipal attorneys and others around, well, what does economic development mean? And we can spend months trying to work through, does this thing that we need to do fit into that, and then having to justify it. So I think if there's language that can allow for those purposes to occur without coming back each time, and that's what this bill does to a large extent, but that might be some additional language that is still useful and kind of what are optional exemptions for, and then we can think through what community and economic development mean and how it's implemented. The clearer you can be, the better. And I like the conversation around for the value of $75,000, and how does that what does that mean for multifamily homes or other types of development? And the size of a project matters, and $75,000 doesn't if it's a very large project. So I think that's why things related to economic development make a lot more sense. But it's definitely tied to something other than residential property.
And I think one of the tricky things about having that broad language about an optional property tax exemption for economic development purposes is that is very broad, but there's also some things on that same list that are extremely specific. So that could be where some of those hesitations come in, of that broad language being on the same list as things that are very specific. So yeah, like, does that kind of go in there, and do we need to be more specific, and where, you know, folks with a different perspective than mine are a little bit more cautious. Representative Hemshute.
Oh, I have so many questions still. Thank you, through
we
the chair.
20 more minutes.
Okay. I wanted to start with Mr. Nelson and just a quick question about the industrial exemptions. Those would be state exemptions, right? Or would municipalities have industrial exemptions?
Through the chair, State Assessor Dan Nelson. I did actually update that number, and it is just how it's been classified by the local jurisdictions, whether they classify it as commercial or industrial. I'd have to look in further into that, but I've added the industrial number, and it's so the exempt that is optionally exempt residential is 6.7 a billion versus now it is 285 million for total exemptions for commercial and industrial.
It went down.
So I'm sorry, I got lost there. I have 6.7 billion for residential exemptions and 363 million for commercial exemptions, and now I was curious about industrial, which I guess is a locally determined what is commercial versus industrial. So with knowing that it's a local designation, what is the industrial total exemptions?
Through the chair, Dan Nelson, State Assessor, sorry for the confusion. It did go up. Total was 384 million versus only the commercial was 363 million. So the total exempt industrial real property is 21.5 million.
Got it. Okay. Different
math
question.
On the fly.
Yeah, he's doing great.
Representative Hemshute.
Thank you. I wanted to go to the local assembly members and find out what their current exemptions are. What are your optional exemptions in each of your communities, and are any of those at that $75,000 level?
We'll start with Assemblymember Brawley, who has a hard out here very shortly.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, Representative Nishu, Anna Bali with Anchorage. We have a number of exemptions. So we have our mandatory senior and disabled veteran exemptions, so that's required by the state. Ours is $150,000. We have not increased that. We have our $75,000 residential exemption. So, again, voters approved that a few years ago to increase after it increased in state law. And then, to my knowledge, the rest of our exemptions are really, well, I should say there's also, I'm sending a follow-up. There's a number of the other required ones, for example, federal, state, charitable, nonprofit, hospital. Those are all in state law. So we obviously honor those. Those are our code. And then the optional ones that we have, some relate with personal property, which is also impacting mobile homes that are considered personal property and not real property for purposes of taxation. And then most of the other ones we have are economic development related, a few community purpose. And so I can provide a full list, or I can ask our assessor to. But a number of them really are trying to help redevelop aging properties, deteriorated property, or encourage housing. It's a theme. Thanks.
Through the chair, any of those at the $75,000 level?
Yes, thank you for the follow-up. So through the chair, the $75,000 is the residential, that's the maximum. For the rest of them, I think a number of the mandatory ones may exceed that, but again, it depends on, for example, the church property is worth, you know, $1 million, something like that, then that would be the full amount of their exemption. But otherwise, I think most of them are project-specific and time-limited, so they would be over 75, but they're not necessarily 75 for the next 50 years, if that makes sense.
Thank you.
Thank you. Assemblymember Rodermund.
Yes, thank you. So similar to Anchorage, obviously, you know, we obviously honor all the state mandated exemptions. Other than that, I think you kind of caught me here. I honestly cannot think of any right off the top of my head other than the state ones. I could certainly get back to you on that. I would defer to our staff on that. So nothing that stands out. Sorry. Thank you.
That's all right. It's not stuff we deal with every day. And then Assemblymember Steininger.
Thank you. Of course, here in Juneau, we have the mandatory exemptions. We also have an exemption for hardship for senior and disabled veteran hardship exemption. We have an exemption related to historic property repairs and also some economic development exemptions as well. We do have a list similar to well, Assemblymember Brawley said we have a comprehensive list. It includes both our property and our sales tax exemptions. I can provide to the committee to see as well.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Mr. Andreasen, are there any that are jumping out in your mind that from other communities that might be noteworthy?
Yeah. Chair Mears, I think that my understanding of and how I've seen optional exemptions appear is usually it's one jurisdiction whose attorney isn't sure they can do something and needs you to tell them they can. So that's often where these come from. It's usually a general law, a second class city or borough who needs to do something, but it takes legislation. So often these aren't broadly applicable. A lot of jurisdictions can do a lot with the existing exemptions. And I don't know, and this, I think we can chase this down, when do any of those optional exemptions hit that $75,000 bar? I think that's definitely worth pursuing. But I don't have that offhand.
Oh, thank you very much. Co-chair Hemshoot.
Thank you, through the co-chair. Nonprofits are generally exempt. Is that a locally determined exemption?
Representative Hemshoot, through the chair, that's in the Constitution and in statute. It's mandated.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Co-chair Hemshoot, do you have more questions?
Well, I just wanted to comment. I mean, I think I'm running out of steam, but I am concerned that we haven't even started on section one of the bill, and I think that's going to be another whole I mean, maybe it's straightforward. but I need to understand more about that section as well. I guess I was hoping maybe Mr. Andreessen could talk a little bit more about the idea of a percentage. So instead of a 75K going with a percentage of the value of the home, or the, I guess I'll say residential property. So is there a way to not run afoul of, I don't know, the Constitution maybe, with doing a percentage but applying up to a home of a certain value? So giving people a percentage exemption when they own a multi-million dollar property, my guess is their need for that exemption is not as great as someone who owns a $200,000 property, which in Sitka could be a trailer. So my question is there a way to do this instead of at a $75,000 threshold, make it a percentage? And then if we did that, is there a way to – would municipalities be allowed to apply it to some homes and not
make it fair?
Yeah, and Assemblymember Brawley also said this should be something that belongs to an individual, and yet I think it talks about one home being eligible. Like, the individual has the characteristics of being a senior or whatever.
Sure.
But what if a senior owns multiple properties? So any thoughts on all of that?
Representative Hemshoot through the chair. There's a lot, a lot there, and I think a few things. So, yes, you could do – so 75,000 is a funny – any firm number is funny, right? So all exemptions we could just say are 74,999, right? Like, that's how you get around hard numbers like that. And so we have to kind of keep in mind, how do you make sure that like the numbers that you're using are reasonable, are meaningful, and you know, ultimately make the impact that you want them to. I think that's why percentages have a different value. So you could do percent of value by property, and you could do variation. So by property, you can just define property in different ways. So primary residents get this, you know, it's a percentage for primary residents. For short-term rentals or others, you could have a different percentage. The mill rate's the same, and that's, I think, important. But what you're doing is basically different. You're doing preferential valuation to some extent when you're applying a percentage exemption to different types of property. So I think you can scale up or down based on property type and then just define the types of property that you're applying that to. That's one way, I think, to get to variation. And that's basically, I think, what Montana's done in recent property tax legislation. It's uniform mill rate, but the exemptions are by type of property, and value of property is the trigger. You could have a revenue impact trigger, and I think this is probably more meaningful overall, but complicated. So that revenue is, so at what point does it result in a mill rate increase, or you know, ultimately, you know, affect how much is taxed of what's remaining of assessed value. And you could do that by exemption program. So for every type of exemption that a local government implements, it could evaluate how much of our revenue is this affecting, if we were to increase it or decrease it. And that would be the trigger that would result in voters needing to take action or otherwise be involved. And then I think we should be thinking about cumulative impact of all of these exemptions. To what extent are we really undermining the tax base and truly cost shifting in a way that isn't helpful for community and economic development? And I don't know what those numbers should be. If 24% is optionally exempted already, and some jurisdictions are 8% or 10% or 16% that they've optionally exempted, like that's significant. And it's not widespread, but for those jurisdictions, we really have to think about what that total looks like. And it might not be that, you know, we can go back in time, but as programs are added or as additional exemptions are considered, what does that do to what's already existing? So those are some comments for as much as I maintain the thread of what your question was. I will maybe just say there's a couple, I mean, there's some things that have come up in today's meeting that, you know, we talked about in the original hearing as well, but there's some easy fixes that would give, you know, local government some confidence. So there's what about existing exemptions, and it could be that they're okay based on the bill, but you could add something like an exemption ordinance in effect on the effective date remains in effect until amended or repealed. So that makes sure that local governments that currently are using these optional exemptions have some surety that they remain in place. You could have a phase-out provision that if all of these remain in place for between 1 and 3 years, unless they're readopted by the municipality, which could be by ordinance if it's under 75,000, or go to a vote of the people if you want them to reconsider the exemptions that that are currently impacting them. So those are technical fixes that I think we should be thinking about. And the other thing that's come up, I mean, I think just when we're thinking about voters, is how do we make sure there's not voter fatigue? And what are the tools that local governments have to bundle these different exemptions? If it's by property, how do we not go out for every single property that's got a value over 75,000, but bring all that together under a programmatic angle or not? But I wanted to make sure that those conversations weren't lost in and among the debate around 75,000 and at what point are voters involved. There's some like easy technical fixes that make this clearer for local governments to implement if it were to become law.
Thank you very much. Representative Holland has some questions as well. Representative Holland.
Thank you to the chair, maybe through the chair. I think at this point in time, I just want to observe, it's a question, but I don't know if we can get to it. At this point in time, I'm still not clear on what the state public policy justification is for why we're controlling optional exemptions. We're getting into the weeds about 75 and how to do all the machinations on how that's implemented and exemptions and whatnot, but I've lost track of why is the state involved in this at all. And there's probably good reasons, and I need help to, at some point, maybe in another conversation, map out what is the state public policy interest in having some say in local property taxes. And if we could understand what good and what benefit is there from our policy, it might help frame what our policy should be. Should we be mandating which types of properties or how much value, or perhaps should we be mandating differentials between one community adjacent to another community so that there's fairness between communities, or should we be looking at it in terms of cost-shifting issues? But I want to go back up to figure out why is the state mixed up in this issue. I get that there was a reason.
That's what you're trying to solve.
30 or 40 years ago why we were involved, because we were having to pay for it. Mm-hmm. But I think at this point in time, since we're no longer paying for it, then it seems like maybe the original justification to even be in this topic has maybe changed. So rather than getting into all the weeds of how to further complicate the issue, I'm wondering if there's a different way to look at the issue. And maybe if we do, then it's a little easier to get into which policies should we define and guide versus which ones can we just step away from and not have to figure out the weeds. So it's kind of a question, but at this point in time, if there's a quick answer or perspective, that's great. If not, I'll just kind of leave it as kind of, I don't know where we're, what problem we're solving right at the moment.
Well, Representative Holland, I think that's exactly why we're here, is to untangle that and to like leave all the little things up to local government and step back out of it. Representative Colom.
So through the chair to Rep. Holland. So it's funny that you asked that, because when this came up, I started asking some old timers around the building and ask them, why do they have to get permission from us? Some of it was to the Assemblyman Roman spoke about, that when the state was in its infancy, and the boroughs weren't really developed. And I think they were, what I'm getting is that the state wanted to control those exemptions because they didn't want the boroughs coming to the state for money. So if they, like, if they were not sophisticated in taxing and whatever, if they started exempting things, they didn't want the state to come to come to the state for more revenue. But again, that's when we were just starting. That's when oil was just starting. Things were just developing. And I think there just was kind of a mentality that still exists in other areas today that the state needs to babysit the municipalities. I mean, I'm just like, it's blunt, but I have that example in Anchorage. I don't understand why Anchorage doesn't take care of its own roads. Well, it's always done like, you know, DOT just takes care of it. Well, find a city where the state is doing that. They're usually interstate roads. But anyway, there's been many areas that I've seen where the state is big brother, and we don't really need to be that anymore. We can let them go. Let the children run. Let them make their own decisions. And this was such a great conversation. I mean, it got pretty in-depth. But I just want to remind everybody, I'm trying to solve that problem. Why is the state making municipalities ask for permission for optional tax exemptions? I want the municipalities to figure that out. And if you notice, our meeting kind of worked as an assembly meeting today. When we're trying to figure out how everything is going to trigger, you know, the education funding, whatever, that's what the assemblies can do this. They're smart enough. They can figure it out. They would be able to have the same discussion we had today. You know, how does this mix in with the optional and the mandated, and figure out their revenue and have the freedom to be able to do what they need to do for their local community. That's all I'm trying to do. And really, I mean, I really appreciate all the time, Co-Chair Mears, because in some ways it's a complicated problem, and in some ways it's not at all. Where I left that $75,000 exemption in for the discussion. I wanted to draft the bill without it and just get it out and just let local municipalities deal with it. But I thought the discussion was worth it. If you want to simplify it, you would just take that out and let the local governments figure out what they want to do. If they want to require a vote of the people or not. This is really, you know, to me, this bill is really just a focus on the state's role and local control.
Thank you. A final comment from Co-Chair Hemshoot before we close out.
Thank you for that opportunity, and thanks for the sort of wrap-up comments. I just want to mention, I'm aware of communities, even first-class communities, that have a hard time getting people to serve on the assembly. So the assembly people we heard from today are incredibly capable of exactly what you're talking about. And I'm sure that the support would be there for other assemblies that struggle even to fill their seats to make sure that they have an eye on how all of this works. So I agree, the best decision is made closest to the people impacted, the community that's impacted. I just want to make sure we don't lose track of the not every place is Juneau, Anchorage, or Fairbanks. And so we need to think about what does this look like in those tiny places that need a lot of support still. Thanks.
So that will conclude our discussion on HB 291 and our discussion for today. We will set House Bill 291 aside. On Thursday, we'll be hearing two bills, HB 377, Public Records, Audio and Visual Muni Costs, for a committee substitute that will be distributed tomorrow and for public testimony. We will also have an introduction to House Bill 379, Service Area Elections. With no further business before the committee today, the meeting is adjourned at 10:01 a.m. Yeah.